Welcome to this Wednesday edition on what has turned out to be a beautiful day in eastern North Dakota. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we are glad that you are with us. Lots to cover today, including an essay on why insects are essential to bird survival, a conversation with Fergus Falls restaurateur Evan Bergdahl, and a look at the troubling rise in missing youth cases here in North Dakota. And we begin Main Street today with another edition of Philosophical Currents. It's my monthly discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota. And every month we step back from the headlines to ask deeper questions, how values, ethics, and philosophy shape the world around us. And today we turn to the Trump administration's decision to cut funding for hundreds of National Institute of Health projects studying health disparities. Research that looked at why minorities and low-income Americans experience higher rates of illness, shorter lifespans. Supporters say this prevents taxpayer dollars from funding woke science, and critics argue that it undermines decades of progress towards health equity. What does this decision say about justice, equality, and the role of government in protecting public health? Jack, welcome back to Main Street.
Oh, I'm happy to be here and transitioning into the new semester for UND. So this is a good way to get my brain working and to be prepared for the harder conversations.
What do philosophers mean, Jack, by health equity and justice in healthcare? How are these different from equality?
These are very complex terms with long histories, but the basic insight is as follows. When we talk about equality, we mean a wide range of things. We can mean people are politically equal in the sense that one person gets one vote. We can suggest that everyone is equal under God. Maybe we are all sinners, or maybe we will all be judged. We all have a certain kind of equal worth and equal dignity. And equality can also mean a sort of identicalness, a sort of interchangeability. And in that sense, we are obviously not equal. Some of us are faster than others. Some of us are smarter than others. Some of us are taller than others or stronger than others. Some of us are more emotional than others. We want to be able to distinguish between when we say people are equal and people are the same. And when you distinguish between people's differences, then you have this different notion of equity, where equity is the idea that being treated equally means having access to certain things, having access to adjusted situations. I tell my students, my students can recite this with me. Every single class I ever teach, I suspect, I said the same thing. I said, if you learn anything from my classes, it's this phrase: treating people equally is not the same thing as treating people identically. And here, I'll say that again, because it's a nice phrase. Treating people equally is not the same thing as treating people identically. And here's what I mean by that. Everyone has an equal right to go to the bathroom, right? Everyone has an equal right not to soil themselves in front of friends and colleagues or their kids. Everyone has an equal right to not to have access to these basic biological functions. But some people are bigger, some people are in wheelchairs, some people need caregivers, some people have other issues. And so we have different bathroom stall sizes to make up for this difference. The equality is everyone gets to go to the bathroom. The equity is that everyone has access to a toilet that's big enough for them and their needs, so their equality can be met. And that's the fundamental insight between equity and equality. Equality is we all are entitled to certain things, and equity is the way that we meet the needs of the particular person or context.
The Trump administration, Jack, argues that focusing on racial or socioeconomic groups is in and of itself divisive. We even heard that today in discussions about the Smithsonian, that we can't look on our flaws, it's divisive. And then they also argued that that funding should follow clinical need, not identity. Philosophically, how do we weigh identity against the universality I guess, in public policy.
So I want to make note of something you said, which we really need to spend a whole other conversation on, which is this fact that divisiveness is bad. The fact that when you face controversy, that when you face conflict, there's something wrong with that and it should be avoided. We live in a democracy. A democracy is built on conflict. A democracy is built on disagreement. Only authoritarian, communist, cult-like societies, everyone has the same opinion. No one disagrees about things, right? Sometimes we disagree about whether ice cream should be chocolate or vanilla. And sometimes we disagree on who should be the president. Sometimes we disagree on who should be our boyfriends or girlfriends or what have you, right? So just the idea that divisive concepts are bad runs counter to everything a democracy stands for. Now, with that said, I want to bring up for a second my definition, and it's not really mine, but it's the definition I use of feminism in my classes, right? When we think of feminism, we think of a political movement that argues for women's rights. There's a lot of baggage in terms of what people think feminists may or may not be and women's attitudes towards men and all that kind of stuff. But the definition that I have found most useful out of the history of philosophy for feminism is the philosophy that regards gender as a legitimate category of inquiry. I'll say that again and I'll say what that means, right? Feminism is the philosophy that says that gender is a legitimate form of inquiry. And what that means is when you're trying to learn about the world, it's okay to compare men and women. That's it. That's all feminism really means. If you want to learn about the world, it's okay to look at and compare men and women. Why? Because there is a certain insight that once you are aware of these truths, necessarily you're going to want to ask certain questions or you're going to want to learn certain things. So let's say we take 20 men. And we take 20 women and we ask them, we'll do a basic question. Did you wash the dishes today? If 19 men said no, and one man said yes, and 19 women said yes, and one woman said no, we've learned something. We've learned that there are patterns. We've learned that there are behaviors that are associated with men and women. We don't know that it has to be there. We don't know why it's there. We don't know other things, but a whole list of questions follow. If you were to ask a similar question, let's say you take 20 random white people and 20 random black people, and you ask the question, do you have sickle cell anemia? And 19 white people say no, and one says yes, and 19 black people say yes, and one says no, we've learned something. And I'm not, of course, suggesting that 95% of African-Americans have sickle cell anemia, but it is a much more common illness in the black community. So the next question is why? Why are black people more inclined to get sickle cell anemia? That's the question that all of these grants seek to ask. They look at certain populations, they compare it, they see, let's say, people with freckles are more likely to get skin cancer. Okay, let's look and compare what happens with skin, with freckles and not freckles, to see what we learn about cancer, to help not just people with freckles, but people without freckles. Women with very large breasts are much more prone to back injuries. Well, what's going on there? What does that teach us about backs? What does it teach us about how to prevent back injuries that will help not just women with very large breasts, but other people as well? All of these studies say when we look at a specific population, we learn that there are different patterns and different things that we have to be concerned with. And by looking at those populations, we learn more about the science and we learn more about how to help smaller populations, but also everybody.
We're enjoying our conversation with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a distinguished professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota. And today we're talking about the Trump's decision the Trump administration's decision to cut funding for hundreds of NIH projects, National Institute of Health projects, studying health disparities. Jack, I understand what you just said. It makes sense to me that if we can recognize these things, why then don't we all feel a moral obligation? And what is that moral obligation to study, as you said, why? Even if it means focusing on race, income, or gender, why don't we all feel that way?
You have asked one of the deepest and hardest questions in the history of philosophy. It is certainly one of the oldest, and it takes two forms. The first is the foundational question, which is, why be moral? Why does a person have an obligation to be a good person? Why do people have obligations to care for other people? Why do we care that it's wrong to murder? Why do we care that it's wrong to randomly chop people's limbs off? Why is it bad that people starve to death, right? So that fundamental question, why morality is important and why people should be moral, is a subject of great debate. The next question, though, is who should we care about? Do we treat everybody as an object of consideration? Do we only treat or do we only care about the people we love? Do we only care about some people who do good things for us, right? The history of humanity is a history of declaring us and them, of identifying in groups and out groups. And many societies have had different ethical rules for the different societies. So the word barbarian actually is the Greek word for non-Greek. In the classical Greek world, there were two kinds of people. There were Greeks and there were non-Greeks. There were Greeks and there were barbarians. And the word barbarian comes from the fact that the classical Greeks thought that foreign languages, when people spoke things that were other than Greek, sounded like this, bar, 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 bar. And that's where the word barbarian comes from. And the Greeks had rules. If you captured a fellow Greek in war, you had to treat them a certain way. If you captured a non-Greek, you could do whatever you wanted to do. If you interacted with Greeks in a certain way, you had to follow certain rules. If you acted with non-Greeks, you didn't have to follow those rules. We actually see this in some Muslim countries, where it is very common experience for non-Muslim women to be harassed, approached, sexually propositioned, because the respect that some, and of course I'm saying some, right? Some Muslim men have for Muslim women is not the same as the respect they have for non-Muslim women, because they believe you treat Muslim women different than you treat non-Muslim women. We have attitudes about North Dakotans and non-North Dakotans. We have attitudes about all of these different categories. And so part of what we are debating in our society right now is what constitutes legitimate categories and what constitutes illegitimate categories. What is it fair to say? And this is actually, it's kind of a reverse, because for a very long time, folks on the quote unquote left have argued that race is a made up concept, that it's a social construct, that it's an invention. And so now people on the right, quote unquote, are responding by saying, okay, if race is a made-up invention, then we're not going to look at it in our studies, right? The flip side, of course, is whether race is made up or not, we still organize people that way. We still treat people differently accordingly. And so the question, the consistent philosopher is going to ask the following. Why is it that we can look at, we'll say Mexicans, why is it we can look at Mexicans if we are ICE to try to capture them and push them out of this country, but we're not allowed to look at Mexicans when we ask, how do we stop them from getting cancer? How do we stop them from getting diabetes? How do we make sure Mexicans have healthy, good lives? Right. And I should say Mexican Americans, I should say people of Mexican descent, right? I mean, it gets very, very complicated very quickly. But what we are facing right now is this incredible contradiction in that we use these categories to hurt people, and we are trying to ignore these categories to harm people. And maybe it should be the other way around.
In an article that I shared with you, I noted that some canceled projects, like those on Black maternal mortality or dementia in minority groups, have actually shown to benefit all patients, regardless of race. And it just seems to me that this is an example of targeted injustice gone wrong when it could produce universal gains.
Again, the philosopher in me wants to say several different things. The first is, you're absolutely right that all of this research can help everybody. The research that sent us to the moon helped create GPS. It helped create seatbelts for cars. There are a whole bunch of other things, right? The famous example that people always use is that the search for Alzheimer's disease invented Viagra, right? That's how they discovered Viagra, was they were looking for a cure for Alzheimer's disease, right? So yes, this can cure everybody. But just because it can cure everybody doesn't mean it's good if it can only cure somebody. I always tell my students, I hate when a teacher says to you, you should raise your hand because if you have a question, other people in the class have that same question. I always say, if you have a question, raise your hand because your question is important because you're important. Right? And so even if these illnesses only helped a small segment of the population, even if they only helped one person, that's still one person who deserves to be helped, right? And so the argument for universal benefit is very important, but so is this idea that all individuals are very important. And so again, it goes back to this question, is who do we think is worth caring about and who do we think are worth helping?
What is muddied for me as my life goes on is, what does it mean to pursue the common good, and what is the common good? And I think we have kind of touched on many topics that should make folks question what that means, Jack.
This is absolutely right. And we talked about this when we talked about individuality in war and parental responsibilities with children. Going back to this thing about democracy and conflict. Plato and many other philosophers tried to create societies that were filled with harmony, that they argued that everyone's self-interest could somehow be harmonized so that there would be a common good, and helping one person would help lots of people. As philosophy matured, as politics matured, and especially during the 18th century, one of the things that the founders were trying to do with the United States Constitution, with forming the United States, was to recognize that self-interest often conflicts, and that sometimes people need access to clean water, but that means the farmer doesn't get the access to water for their crops. Or money has to go to Alzheimer's disease instead of alopecia, or something like that, right? The modern nation state, the modern democracy, recognizes that there's always a negotiation with resources, and that not everyone can get what they want. And so we have to investigate these ideas of equality, what they mean, investigate these ideas of equity, what they mean, and try to do our best to be fair to all of the people, population, and in a democracy, not say one race is privileged, one sex is privileged, one economic class is privileged. There's a fundamental sense of equal representation, equal justice, equal dignity. And I just want to say one other thing, although I know this answer has been long. There's another wrinkle in it, in which when we talk about health, we are talking about science. And science brings in a whole other subject about that involves talking about objective truth and talking about how the world really is. And we know that you can't wish cancer away, right? We know that even if you pray with all of your heart, I mean, I know there are some people who will disagree with this, but I don't think I'm going on a limb here and saying that you can't pray away cancer. And so what do? You have to look to science. You have to learn about radiation therapy and chemotherapy and different treatments and what kind of food is better. That, you know, I know someone who is going through cancer treatment right now. And one of the things they said to him is he can't lose more than 2 pounds. And the fact that they know this, the fact that they know that that helps the therapy is science. And to take politics and to try to undermine the search for truth, to take politics and say, we are going to insist that the objective independent world of, let's say, cancer bends to our current political view of who we think is important and who isn't, again, misrepresents how the world works.
We visit every month with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. The segment is called Philosophical Currents. Jack is a distinguished professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota, ready to start his new school year. Jack, we wish you the best as students come to campus, and thank you so much for joining us again on Main Street.
It is a pleasure, and I always feel like we've just started.
We'll continue on. A body like Arnold with a Denzel face. He's smart like a doctor with a real good rep. And when he comes home, he's relaxed with pep. He always got a gift for me. Main Street continues on this Wednesday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and in this Natural North Dakota essay, Chuck Lura explores the surprising role insects play in the diets of birds and why those connections matter.
No doubt there are many North Dakotans that have been feeding the hummingbirds this summer. Hummingbird feeders seem to be a common item in backyards across the country. I suspect that most people give it little, if any, consideration, but hummingbirds need to eat something other than sugar water. All animals need a source of protein in their diet for a whole host of reasons, including to produce, for example, muscles and other tissues, hormones, and enzymes. I was thinking about all that recently when I saw an article in the July-August issue of Smithsonian Magazine. The article addressed the importance of insects in bird diets. Part of the article centered on the diets of juncos. Most North Dakotans are likely familiar with this bird. They're a gray, rather plump, sparrow-sized bird with a pink bill, white underside, and white feathers on the outermost margins of the tail. They're a common winter residence in the region and are often observed feeding on the ground beneath bird feeders, cleaning up the spillage. Juncos are generally considered to be seed eaters, but the seeds in their diet do not provide enough protein for their feather production and molting. So during these periods, and perhaps others, the juncos consume insects to meet their protein requirements. The article notes that around 90% of all bird species rely on insects during some period of their life cycle, for example, to produce feathers, eggs, and feed their young. And as many hunters know, insects are important food items for pheasant chicks. We know that insects are important in several ecological processes, such as pollination and nutrient cycling, and insect populations are declining at around a 1 to 2% per year. Many bird populations are also on the decline, and habitat loss is often cited as a major factor. But the decline of insect populations may also be a factor. Perhaps their importance to bird populations may warrant greater attention. There's no doubt that some insect species taste better and are more nutritious than others, and the populations of many bird species and insect species appear to be closely linked. So as you observe the birds and insects around you, give some consideration to the linkages between these two groups, even if a bird species is not generally considered to eat insects. Oh, one last item. A hummingbird's diet is overwhelmingly composed of insects and spiders. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
Still ahead on Main Street, we'll meet a restaurateur from Fergus Falls and address the troubling story of missing youths here in North Dakota. Stay with us.
like bagels.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
And there's that music we look forward to every Wednesday here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Thanks for joining us. We're joined by Evan Birkdahl. He's the driving force behind two restaurant gems in Fergus Falls. And a hint, we're going to have an announcement that might change that number. But currently, Toast and Union Avenue Bar and Eatery. Toast has become known for its creative specialty toast and French-style omelets, where Union Avenue offers wood-fired pizzas, craft cocktails, and a standout summer walleye special. It's in full season right now. Around Lakes Country, Evan has earned the reputation as one of the hardest working people in the food business. And today we get to meet him. Evan, welcome to Prairie Plates.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Of course, the host of Prairie Plates is with us, Rick Guillon. Rick, how are you this morning?
I'm doing well, and it's great to have Evan on from the heart of Lakes Country in Minnesota. Fergus Falls, Minnesota, what a great town.
Start with your path, Evan. What inspired you to get into the restaurant business?
Yeah, so it all kind of started when I was getting my generals at M-State in Fergus Falls, kind of not really knowing what I wanted to do, just getting started post-high school. I got a job in my first real kitchen, and it wasn't really the passion for food that got me started. It was the industry. I liked the long hours, getting up early, staying up late, just having fun. You know what the classic line cooks, we have fun. And like through that, I just, on a whim, pretty much decided culinary school. So I looked up what our options were in the area, and I saw M-State Moorhead had it, and I signed up for the one stop to enroll 2 weeks before school started. Nothing really holding me back. I just decided to jump in, and through that is when I kind of developed the passion for food. And it wasn't there growing up. I had no idea how to cook. So I went in raw and, yeah, built that passion for food. And after that, I reached out to Sarah Watson. She hopped in as an instructor at M-State. That was how we established that connection. And then it was just kind of through there, it just took off. I learned so much under her, and we started doing stuff together, and yeah, here we are.
You'll find that a lot of really good cooks around here take the community college local route. Chef Ryan with the Luna Network of Restaurants did the same thing, and he's been nominated for several James Beard semifinalists award. And I wouldn't doubt if Evan gets nominated at some point for something like that, because his food at Toast and Union Avenue Barn Eatery in Fergus Falls are, it's just really good.
Evan, I'm curious, we described you, and Rick in his notes to me said you are one of the hardest working men in Lakes Country food. Where does that drive come from?
You know, I wish I had that that answer fully, but and maybe it comes from working class family. Sometimes, you know, a few of my employees, or they call me sick, or I'm crazy for those long hours, but
you're passionate. You
know, I'm very passionate. I like that Rick said that, because when I describe myself, that is the one thing that I'm proud of. I won't say it's culinary skill. It's more just the willingness to work the long hours and keep going and see what else I can add to my plate and just see what I'm made of. I like challenging myself that way.
Well, let's maybe get into the food a little bit and start at Toast, because I drive about an hour east sometimes just to eat at Toast, because I think it's the best brunch in the area. It's just super good. Can you explain some of the, it's called Toast, but some of the toasts you have, and then there's omelets and burgers and other stuff, but maybe go for the toast first.
Yeah, absolutely. So we offer a wide range. We like to have a few Scandinavian theme, because as you know, that's kind of the decor, and the food isn't centered around Scandinavian theme. It's more the decor, but there's some classics on there, like the fricadeller. It's a Swedish meatballs put on a toast, which is, it's fun. It's a twist on that classic Swedish meatball. We have another Scandinavian classic called the fläskesteg, which is like a roast pork with house pickles and mustard aioli. A lot of our stuff is on a Dakota wheat that's made locally. Another very, very popular one is the smoked salmon toast. We just take a soft-boiled egg, smoked salmon, gravlax, fresh dill, whatever microgreens we can get locally, we throw on there. That's kind of our range of toasts. Another popular one is the mushroom toast, which a lot of the Fargo Moorhead people make comments about that one being one of the best. It's real simple. It's just thyme cream cheese, roast mushrooms, balsamic, and an egg, but it's just a perfect match.
And that mushroom toast is my favorite one, but you also have avocado toast, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah, we have this more basic, or I don't even want to say basic, but simple, you know, mashed avocado, whatever vegetables we have in season. Again, we like to, this year we've been focusing even more on sourcing locally with the farmers markets right across the street. Usually Saturday morning, I'm there by, sometimes I'll go a little earlier before they open at like 8:30. I have one farmer that I work with pretty regularly. His name's Rick.
Good
great name.
Name,
by the way. Yeah.
Yes.
Yep. And then I just see what else is around at the market, and I use it either for union or toast. So, yeah.
The omelets are also very good. They're French style, and I really enjoy the hash browns because of the crispy, I'm guessing, panko, toasted panko topping. I may be wrong there, but can you explain a little bit about how to make a French style omelet? It's a little different than your regular diner omelet.
Absolutely. So the biggest thing is you whip your eggs rigorously. So we put a lot of work into whipping up those eggs with a whisk to order each time. But then the next biggest thing is we try not to get any brown on our eggs or caramelization, which a lot of people get around here. And I was a little worried at first because that's like a classic Midwest thing, is to have like a caramelized egg. But with a French style, it's nice, smooth. It's a soft scramble, essentially, made into an omelet. And then you hit it with just a little bit of, we use a lot of butter when we're cooking it. If you do a real traditional, we'll like rub a little butter on the top to make it shiny and glossy. Yeah, French style omelet, just really no caramelization and really whisking up the eggs.
And some of the fillings are unique and really tasty. Like I've had duck sausage, I've had morel mushrooms. I think you really try to make them unique.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's like why on our menu, we just call it omelet du jour, whatever we decide. Usually we run them for about a week at a time. If we get really specialty ingredients, it's usually just a weekend. Like the morel mushrooms, those were gone in about 2 days. I did one, so I used Wild Acres chicken. I did a smoked chicken one recently. I buy their smoked chicken from Wild Acres. Yeah, we have a duck sausage one. It's been a while since we've done that one. I'm glad you remembered that.
Well, let's talk about the Union Avenue side a little bit. There's wood-fired pizzas. There's main courses. I really enjoy the wood-fired pizza. Sometimes I get back from hiking at Glendalough State Park a little too late, so I have to get just a pizza, but you have more than pizza offered there.
Yeah, absolutely. So the two biggest things is we make our own pasta dough, so all of it is rolled out fresh every day. We do tagliatelle and a spaghetti noodle. We make an egg dough, roll it out. Most mornings, some days we can get by with just making the pizza dough for the day. We do a sourdough pizza crust. This summer we launched what we're calling a Minnesota menu. So it's 100% all from Minnesota. We've got a Feller's Ranch Wagyu ribeye. If you haven't heard of Feller's Ranch, it's worth checking out. They do a really high quality Wagyu. We have the walleye, Red Lake walleye. We've got Wild Acres chicken on that menu. And then we have Amor pork, which that one, it started off slow, and now I think it's everybody's favorite. We take like a pork prime rib and we French the bone. And then we put a little like orange chili powder on it. And then we sear it and then we sous vide it to the perfect temperature. Yeah, so those are the four items on the Minnesota menu.
For those not familiar, the Amor pork, it's a meat shop located by Otter Tail Lake.
So, Evan, when someone visits one of your restaurants for the first time, what do you want them to take away from what you provide them?
The biggest thing for me, I think, is they can tell that, one, there's passion behind the food, but I like for the area, I like to be known as like the team that puts the culinary in food. you know, there's dive bars are great. I love dive bars, a good burger. When somebody wants to treat themselves, I like to be known as one of the restaurants in the area where they know that chefs put together their meal. There's been a lot of thought into each ingredient on their plate, and that they just trust us with it.
Rick, what else do you have?
Well, I'm wondering about any special announcements you'd like to make on a new acquisition.
Yeah, we just acquired Falls Baking Company. It's a really exciting time because we use all of their bread at Toast. And so it's fun being able to see the bread being made from start to finish. And then we take the bread, we bring it over to our restaurant and create something. We're creating something truly start to finish. It's going to be fun. We're trying to get more bread into the Fargo-Moorhead area now with Falls Baking Company. So hopefully you guys can see some of those options, offerings in the Fargo-Moorhead area.
And Rick, should we wrap it up?
Yeah, for those traveling through Fergus Falls, how do they check out Toast and Union Avenue? What's the address?
Yeah, so Toast is 116 South Union Avenue. And Union is actually right next door at 114 South Union Avenue. It's right on the main drag. We're connected. You'll see we share a lot of the same staff, just different concepts, essentially under the same roof. Union opens up at 4, and Toast opens up at 7 on the weekdays and 9 on the weekends, and then we're closed on Mondays.
That sounds good. You'll see me soon.
Aha, me too. Our guest has been Evan Birkdahl. He's the driving force behind two restaurant gems in Fergus Falls, Toast and Union Avenue Bar and Eatery. Evan, thanks for joining us on Prairie Plates.
Thanks, guys.
Rick, have a great week.
We'll see you soon, Craig.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy cooperative producing reliable electricity for 140 member rural electric systems in 9 states.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. An article that appeared this past Sunday in the Fargo Forum had this headline: almost a dozen North Dakota children, teens, have disappeared in 17 days. On this week's Prairie Beat, we explore the story that's behind that shocking statistic.
Hi, I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We're back once again for another episode of Prairie Beat.
It's our weekly news podcast, and Danielle, we've covered a wide variety of topics since we started the show just a few months ago. But I really think what we're talking about today is something that deserves a lot more sunlight and attention. Missing people, missing children, and most specifically, missing Indigenous people and children.
Indeed. There was actually an article this week in the Fargo Forum that's shed some light on the subject. It was written by Peyton Haug. The headline said that this summer, almost a dozen North Dakota kids and teens have gone missing. And that is a shocking headline. And Eric, you were actually able to speak with her.
Peyton Haug, she's actually from Wisconsin. She is based in Bismarck for Forum Communications. She wrote about these nearly a dozen kids that were reported missing within a 17-day span in the state.
First off was Deshira Chappelle. She's 14. And then Camila Nara Juarez Perez, age 9. And then Madison Michaela Finch, 16. Angel or Angel Marquis Peltier, 15. Mariah Alexandra Gourneau, 19. Adrian Sky, 5. Abigail Louise Campo, 16. Anais Deschelle Weems, Zion Oka, 16. Zoe Iceman, 16. And then Taven Fox, 15.
Yeah, and half of these children are Indigenous. It's important to really hear their names. Now, thankfully, she did say to me that since her story was published, 5 of those 11 kids were located and are now safe.
Those kids were Deshira, Adrian, Zion, Zoe, and Taven.
But unfortunately, in that same period, 7 more kids have been reported missing. Peyton says she will soon be publishing a follow-up article about it, so we'll hear more about that soon.
I'm really glad you talked to her, Eric, since, you know, she'd be a good source as someone who's been digging into that issue this summer. And, you know, I was able to speak with somebody about this, too, one of Peyton's sources for her story.
This is Prairie Rose Seminole. I'm an advocate for missing and murdered Indigenous relatives. I'm also a filmmaker and a horse mom and a dog mom.
Love that. Prairie Rose Seminole is also an enrolled member of the three affiliated tribes. And during our interview, she did mention that her own family has been affected by relatives going missing. So as an advocate, that does come from a very personal place. And we talked a bit about, quote unquote, missing people. That can really be a loaded term. I mean, to say someone is missing, they went missing, it can mean a number of things. There are, of course, people who are taken, you know, like in the movie sense. They can be held. They can be trafficked. There are people who are unfortunately killed. And then there are people who they leave on their own, either for their own free will reasons. They don't want to be found. Perhaps they're lured away or they run away. There's addiction issues going on sometimes. And there are cases of people who go missing because maybe they're elderly, vulnerable. They wandered off, or maybe a child who was taken by a non-custodial parent. So as you can see, because there are so many ways, so many different reasons a person can technically go missing, there's no one size fits all way to respond.
Yeah, we haven't even touched on internet predators with children, and that's a growing issue as well. So I remember reading in Peyton's article that Prairie Rose said, you know, that tribal communities are disproportionately impacted by a lot of compounding factors. So many people go missing, there's desensitization that happens, and she mentioned something she called jurisdictional gaps, which I found pretty concerning.
Yes, unfortunately, on tribal lands, there's just myriad things going on there, from resources being available or not. There's ongoing systemic and historic issues too, but she also says that does not make any case less important.
And so the data shows that Indigenous young people are disproportionately vulnerable for all kinds of reasons, but no matter why they're missing, that's why we need responses to be urgent from the start.
And Peyton, the author of the article that we're referring to today, Danielle, told me part of the problem too is when these kids go missing, there's not a photo attached to them. And that's a thing. I mean, you can find their photo probably on social media, but if you go to an official site, there might not be an accompanying photo. So that kind of gap is an issue. But the urgency really is so key here, because as you probably know, watching enough true crime shows, in many cases of missing people, chances of finding them alive go down a lot after the first 48 hours. So you'd think those gaps would be imperative to close, right?
Prairie Rose would agree.
Those systems need stronger coordination so that tribal, state, county, federal systems are all communicating and responding quickly.
The article was pretty startling to read, but despite this really grave situation with Indigenous people and children specifically, Prairie Rose does seem pretty optimistic. She says the fact that the article was written at all is demonstrating an increase in awareness to the issue, which is important. And in recent years, progress has been made legislatively. Former State Representative Ruth Buffalo was able to introduce a measure that later passed in the legislature and established a missing Indigenous persons database, so that was meaningful. And sometimes information can be hard to come by. As you said, you know, the photo is not being there. Just this year, we also talked about it on that previous episode, Representative Jamie Davis was able to introduce a bill that was passed and established a new alert system for missing Indigenous children. It's called the Feather Alert. The missing child would have to be specifically classified as having been abducted. So that's a lot like how an Amber Alert works. There's been meaningful political will to address the issue here in North Dakota, and we hope that will go a long way.
Yeah, that's definitely a big deal and big development, and that article certainly got a lot of attention. So this summer, there's been a deserving spotlight on this issue for sure. So now we are starting to see more accurately the scope and just how widespread of an issue it is here in North Dakota. We'll have to see how effective these new resources are in helping to locate any of these missing Indigenous people, and especially children. It's just heartbreaking. No matter how they disappear, whatever the reason, it's important that they're found and found safe. Danielle, I know that while you've been working on this, you've been able to feed some other news stories into the Prairie Public Newsroom. What are some other issues that have been making the news this week?
Well, we had a story the other day about back-to-school immunizations. Schools like to have a 95% vaccination rate to protect the students from serious illnesses. We also had a story about a survey being conducted by North Dakota Health and Human Services. They're looking for feedback so they can shape their new rural health transformation program that was established by the One Big Beautiful Bill. And then speaking of that bill, Senator John Hoeven was in Fargo this week. He was taking questions at a town hall-type meeting with the Fargo Moorhead West Fargo Chamber of Commerce about his work in Washington, D.C.
You hear that? Ow. Mosquitoes. That's another one. I'm going to add that to the mix, Danielle. Did you hear those airplanes dive bombing on West Fargo last night?
Flew right over my house.
I know. Same here. We got to keep an eye out for West Nile virus because some of those numbers are going up everywhere. There's people in the hospital as well. So that and lots of other things are happening. Not a slow summer. Not at all. Well, thanks for breaking it all down for us as well, Danielle.
You bet. Be sure to tune in to Prairie Public for more stories from our newsroom, or you can check us out online at news.prairiepublic.org.
That's right. And thank you. You're the most important part of this Prairie Beat thing that we're doing. Thanks for being with us again this week for another episode. I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
That was the latest episode of our regional news podcast, Prairie Beat. You can subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts or listen at prairiepublic.org. New episodes drop every Wednesday.
The Bush Foundation is accepting applications for the 2026 Bush Fellowship, September 2nd through October 7th until noon central. The Bush Fellowship invests in people and their capacity to do more good for the region. Bush Fellows are committed to leading equitably to create large-scale change. Up to 30 leaders from any sector receive $150,000 to support their self-designed leadership plan. More information can be found online at bushfoundation.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 20th. Continuing our story about taxi warfare and parking meters we introduced on August 12th, it starts with Howard Henry, a noted West Hope, North Dakota farmer, businessman, politician, and civil servant. While doing business in Minot, a patrolman promptly ticketed him. That fatal shot heard round North Dakota led Henry to organize the Parking Meter Petitioning Committee. They drafted an initiated measure for prohibiting parking meters in political subdivisions to be voted on in the 1948 primary election. His main opponent was the League of North Dakota Municipalities. Conversely, they both agreed that Minot policemen could be more courteous in their ticketing. Nonetheless, the ball was already rolling, and both sides stuck to their chosen path. The League, for its part, formed a municipal rights committee to spearhead efforts. Its arguments were twofold. First, it touted parking meters as the best method to regulate parking and promote a rapid turnover of parked cars. Second, it argued that taking away parking meters would not only threaten municipal rights, but democracy itself. Even under this threatening cloud, Henry and the anti-meter group won the primary by 2,500 votes. The League refused to back down, having a judge file an injunction so the meters could continue operating. The Meter Cities filed suit, hoping to declare the initiated measure unconstitutional. The League also organized a referendum campaign for the general election. Parking meters lost again. In January of 1949, the Supreme Court ruled that initiated measures could take away municipal powers, thus ending the first round of parking meters in the state. But the story wasn't over. In 1951, the state legislature legalized them again, returning to the principle that municipalities should regulate their own parking problems. Henry declared rubbish, initiating a referendum campaign that illegalized them again in the 1952 primaries, despite League opposition. Later that year, Bismarck's Chamber of Commerce planted Christmas trees in the former parking meter posts. In 1989, Minot donated a quite old but very little used parking meter to West Hope in honor of Howard Henry. The legislature has taken up parking meters multiple times since, but the laws haven't passed. North Dakota remains the only state without parking meters on public streets. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Cody Goring. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll visit with our movie reviewer, Matt Olean. We do that each and every Thursday, except tomorrow's the last time Matt will make a regular appearance here on Main Street. We'll thank him for all of the great work that he's done, and we'll look forward to what Matt has in store. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope to see you again.